pleasure of introducing our next speaker, who I don't think really needs an introduction, our two-term former governor of Maine, Angus King. He tells me that there's a statute of limitations on having to call him governor, and I must admit it's a little bit hard to call him Angus, but that's how he seems to be, he seems to prefer being addressed. Angus and I and quite a few others in this room serve on the Ocean Energy Task Force, and he also has been traversing the state giving rather impassioned speeches about renewable energy and ocean energy in particular. Currently, he is an energy developer working in partnership with others, a company called Independence Wind. He's done a variety of other things in addition to being governor, serves on many boards, advises both companies here in Maine and internationally. He teaches at Bowdoin College, which must be a real treat for students there. And he is, as I said, very busy doing a lot of ocean outreach about, or a lot of outreach about ocean energy. So please join me in welcoming Angus King.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Oh, better. I was afraid I was the only one awake. The dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate to the stormy present. The occasion is piled high with difficulty. Therefore, we must rise with the occasion. As our case is new, so we must think anew and act anew. We must disenthrall ourselves, and then we shall save our country. Those are the words of Abraham Lincoln, December 2nd, 1862, to the United States Congress. He was talking, of course, about the Civil War, the occasion that was piled high with difficulty. But I think Lincoln's words speak to us, as many of Lincoln's words speak to us today, about how we have to approach problems. My favorite line of that quote is, we must disenthrall ourselves. Which basically means we have to try to look at things in fresh ways. Think of new ways, new solutions. Think of things in ways we haven't before. Ann Hayden this morning asked me, she said, how has your experience of the last few years changed your thinking about the ocean? And I said, that's easy. In the past, I always thought about what was under the ocean. Now I think about what's over it. It's thinking about things in a different way. Your perspective makes all the difference. Your attitude makes all the difference. One of my favorite stories is, I'm sure you know this kid. Maybe one of your kids. Christmas Day comes and there's a big pile of presents under the tree. The kid goes down and opens all the presents, and about an hour later he looks and says, is this all? You know that kid? Another kid comes down and there's nothing in the living room at all except over in one corner he finds a little pile of horse manure. And he's really excited. He's fired up. He's bouncing off the walls. His parent says, why are you so happy? He said, because I know there's a pony in here somewhere. See, it's all in your attitude and your outlook on things. Now, I want to talk a bit about, I'm going to talk about energy, and I'll get to the ocean eventually, okay? So be patient. But first, I want to give you a bit of a perspective about energy in Maine in a way that perhaps you haven't thought of. I hadn't thought of until I started really concentrating on this in the summer of 2008. The first thing to understand about energy in Maine, when most of us talk about energy, we think electricity. CMP, Bangor Hydro, that's what you think. That's 10% of the energy used in Maine. Electricity is 10% of the energy. 40% is heating our homes and buildings. 40%. 50% is powering our vehicles. So when you talk about energy in Maine, if you're only talking about electricity, you're missing 90% of the issue. So we have to, that's sort of the beginning of the way to think about it. Now, the second thing to know about that chunk of that energy budget, if you will, is that 55% of the 10%, 55% of the electricity in Maine, roughly, comes from natural gas, fossil fuels. A little bit from oil, a little bit from nuclear down in New England. There's even some coal in our electricity mix in Maine, which I didn't realize until recently from other parts of New England. But anyway, 55% fossil fuel. Home heating, 80% oil, highest percentage in the United States. 80% home heating, 80% of the homes in Maine heated with oil. Cars and trucks, of course, 99.9% fossil fuels. I do know, I have a friend in Falmouth who has converted a truck to go work, run on wood. And even that is that's a fossil fuel. But, so if you do the math on those percentages, it comes up to between 85 and 90% of all the energy used in Maine is based upon fossil fuels. How much fossil fuel production takes place in Maine? Zip. Zero. Nil. Nada. Zilch. None. Is that prudent? Is that safe? To have the basic building block of your whole economy and society controlled entirely outside of the borders of your state, and indeed much of it controlled outside the borders of our nation by people who don't like us very much. I don't think that's a terribly sensible way for us to conduct ourselves. Two or three years ago, I was invited to visit the country of Singapore. It's a really interesting country. 4.5 million people essentially on an island. No natural resources. It's one of the richest countries in the world. The reason is they really invest in their people. They have the best education system in the world. They always score at the top of all those tests. By the way, you might wonder, why the hell was Angus in Singapore? They wanted to know how to do a laptop project. Isn't that cool that the people in Singapore look to Maine to teach them how to improve what is already one of the world's best education systems? In any case, while I was there, I learned an interesting thing. Singapore used to get all of their fresh water through a big pipe from Malaysia under the strait. All their fresh water for drinking and everything else. And somebody, I don't know how long ago it was, 10 or 12 years ago, said, this isn't really prudent. We get along okay with the Malaysians. We're not at war with them. We're not in any dispute with them. But it doesn't make real good sense that all of our water, which is another basic building block of our society, comes from someplace else, a different country. So they invested in desalinization and reverse osmosis, and now Singapore is virtually water independent. There's a lesson there, it seems to me. It just is prudent to not be so totally dependent on a resource that you have no control over. When we wake up in the morning, the price of oil is set. You can't bargain on it. Your local oil company can't really bargain. I mean, you can lock in a price for the next 2 or 3 months or something, but basically we have no control over this. It is a worldwide commodity. Okay. What does that mean? What does it mean for Maine? Forgetting about the fact that it's just not safe or prudent to be that vulnerable. But what does it mean in economic and human terms? Well, here's a number that you can have in your head. You can think about it when you drive around and look at the price of gas. For every dollar that gasoline or home heating oil goes up, $1.2 billion a year disappears out of the Maine economy. So just, remember in 99 gas was a buck? It's now closing in on 3, so 2 times 1.2 billion, about $2.5 billion a year is leaving Maine, and we get nothing for it. $2.5 billion, by the way, is more than the income tax and the sales tax combined. Imagine if the legislature said, we're going to double the income tax and the sales tax, and by the way, we're going to send all the money to Venezuela, because we really like the Venezuelans. We get, it's like a tax, But we get nothing for it. No teachers, no roads, no hospitals, no health care, no social workers, no marine resources department. It's a tax that we get nothing for. So, you know, I just did a little calculation. I don't know if you've noticed, gasoline's gone up about 10 cents in the last week, last 10 days. It was 2.59 a week or so ago. I noticed on the way up it's 2.71. Okay, that 10 cent increase represents a loss to Maine of $120 million a year. That 10 cents, that's a lot of dough. So there's an economic impact. And the impact on families is significant. Back in 99, when it was a dollar, when I was governor, I've never said that before, that's kind of funny. Works for me. It was a dollar. That energy budget I talked about, home heating, cars, electricity, was about 4% of the average family budget in Maine. 4%. At the height of when we were up to $3.50 and almost $4 a gallon in 2008, that 4% was 20%. It's now 12 to 15%, but it's still way more than 4%. And that's money that people don't have to spend on other things. That's money that people don't have to go to the mall or to buy a CD or to buy a jacket or buy winter clothes for their kids. It's a severe, significant ripple effect, economic effect, when this money just evaporates. So from 4% to 12 or 15% today, headed for 20%, that's bad stuff. And if it keeps going, by the way, oil is now $80 a barrel. It was 30 last spring. It got up to 140 in the summer of 08. Where's it going? Beats the hell out of me. I don't know. Nobody knows. But let me play a little game with you. How many of you have fire insurance on your house? Pay fire insurance on your house. Everybody. $400 or $500 a year for a risk that's pretty remote. How often is your house burned down lately? Maybe once in 20 years? Once in 25 years, once in 30 years, you're insuring a risk that is basically on a single day basis about a 1 in 20 or 30,000. That's the risk you're insuring. It's a pretty remote risk, but we're all paying every year. How many of us have insurance against oil prices going up? None of us. What is the risk of oil prices going up? How many of you think oil prices will go up to some extent in the next 3 years? Why the hell aren't we buying insurance? Do you see the point? We're insuring against a very remote risk. We're not doing anything to insure against an almost certain risk, a one-to-one risk. So, you know, where does that leave us, and where are oil prices going? The most profound observation I ever heard about oil prices was from Dick Hill. Some of you probably, I think there's some people from the university, aren't there? Some Arno folks? You know Dick Hill, retired professor of mechanical engineering at Orono. About 25 years ago, I heard him say what turned out for me to be the most profound observation about oil prices I'd ever heard. He said, oil prices in the future will always be the opposite of what you expect. Now, the reason that's so profound is, the way it works is this. If we assume oil prices in the future will be cheap, then we will do things like buying Hummers and not bother with insulating our houses, which will create increased demand for oil, which will make the price high. We assume it's cheap. We act accordingly. It will be high. If we assume it will be expensive and we act accordingly by insulating our houses and buying Priuses and saving on energy, then there will be an excess of oil and the price will be low. The price in the future will always be the opposite of what we expect. I do think that the price in the future is going to go up. Why? Because it's a worldwide commodity, we're in a world market, and here are some stunning figures. One way to get a grasp on energy use worldwide is per capita. You know, to compare America's energy use with Canada's or with France or something, it doesn't really mean anything because you got these big numbers, and what does that mean? But if you do it per person, then you can say, okay, that's apples to apples. Here are the numbers. Don't worry about the units. I think it's millions of BTUs per year. There's no unit called that, but here are the numbers. U.S., 340, okay? 340 million BTUs per year per person. China, 52. India, 14. Sub-Saharan African countries, 8. What does that tell you? That tells you that the demand for this finite resource has got to go up because of the growth around the world. China is building a coal-fired electric plant at the rate of one every 2 weeks. We have no conception in this country of how big China is. Mary and I had a couple of years ago an AFS student, a foreign exchange student from China, from a town called Nanjing, a city called Nanjing. And I said, her name was Ching Ching Tan, wonderful girl, I can tell you lots of great stories. Anyway, I said, I'm just looking for information, I said, Ching Ching, how many kids are in your grade, just your grade, junior in high school, in your city of Nanjing? Just how many kids in one grade in one city? 80,000. 80,000 kids in one grade in one city. We have no conception of the size of this country, and we're at 340 and they're at 52. They are going up. Car sales in China went up 22% last year. And if you remember your sixth grade math, 22% per year compounded doubles it in about 3 years. And then it'll double again. And the most terrifying piece of news I've seen recently is the announcement in India that Tata Motors is building a new car called the Tata Nano, which will sell for $2,500. When the people in Asia start driving automobiles at the rate we do, there will need three planets of oil to supply the fossil fuel necessary unless we find other ways to give ourselves, provide ourselves with energy. So we are really talking, I think, about a freight train headed for us. The problem is we keep getting these little reprieves that make us take our, this is the wrong image, but take our foot off the accelerator of alternatives. I'm old enough to remember Sheikh Yamani, who was the first oil minister of Saudi Arabia in the 70s when OPEC was formed. And he was interviewed on television and somebody said, Sheikh Yamani, what will be the top price that you will take oil to? And he said, that is easy. We will take it to one penny below the level which would induce Americans to do something serious about conservation. These guys are not stupid. And we're going through a process now that reminds me of Muhammad Ali, rope-a-dope, where the prices go up, a huge amount of money flows in, we start to talk about wind power and alternative cars and everything else, and then the price comes down and everybody forgets. Adam Lee, my friend who runs Lee Toyota in Topsom, tells me that he can track Prius sales exactly on the price of gas. In June of 08, when I bought mine, price of gas was very high. They had a 34-person waiting list. I didn't get mine until December. By the time I got mine in December, gas had gone down, and they had 20 unsold on the lot. That's how short our memories are. We're not inclined to do things until the problem is really overwhelming. Winston Churchill said, Americans will always do the right thing, but only after they have tried everything else first. And that's sort of where we are. So if this is a situation and we want to do something about it, okay, I hope I've thoroughly depressed you by this time. The question is, what? I don't like to not talk about solutions. There is no single solution. George is right. There's no silver bullet. But my friend Lori LaChance at the Maine Development Foundation coined what I think is a wonderful term. She said, there's no silver bullet, but there probably is silver buckshot. Isn't that great? Lots of solutions. No single solution. We always want the single solution. There isn't. There are lots of solutions. And the first, of course, is conservation. That's the cheapest, the most readily available, the fastest to implement. There are so many things we can do to use fuel and energy more efficiently. From, you know, changing light fixtures to caring about how we're driving. Here's a simple thing. Dana Murch and I were talking. Both of us have Priuses. If you have a Prius, it has this little screen that tells you how your mileage is from moment to moment. If you overhear that I'm killed in an accident, it's because I'm watching that damn screen. Because I'm convinced, and Dana and I agree, and those of you others who have Priuses, I'm convinced that just having that information has significantly changed my driving habits, and I'm probably getting at least 10 or 15% better mileage just because I know what I'm doing. And there's a really cool thing, and I hope I'm the one that's announcing this to you, that you haven't already heard it, although I think it was on the news this morning. Congresswoman Shelley Pingree from North Haven, right out here, announced either late yesterday or this morning that we're getting a federal stimulus package grant to Maine to buy all of CMP's customers smart electric meters. That's really cool. And CMP will be installing those meters over the next couple of years, and they will enable us to all know more about how it is we're using energy and how it's being used. And Google now has a little app on Google that can interface. You buy a little device that sends a wireless signal to your computer that you interface with this meter and the device, and it will tell you in real time on your screen what you're doing in your house in terms of your electricity use. And we're trying to get Google to work with our kids with the laptops so that they'll have all they have this on the laptops, and then every kid in Maine is an electricity cop. I think that's pretty cool. And again, information, just raw information, will help us. Not to mention things like insulation and all of those kinds of things. So conservation is the first step. And it's a critically important one, but as Tom Friedman says, while we're caulking our windows, they're building whole new cities in China. So it's not enough. It's not the only thing. Even with substantial conservation, energy demand is going to continue to grow, particularly in developing countries. Over the course of economic history, energy demand and GDP growth are locked together. If you read in the paper, GDP grows in China 8.9%, you can mentally say, energy demand grew 8.9%. Now, there's been a little separation in the U.S. as we've done more conservation and efficiency in the last 20 years or so, but by and large, that's a law of economics. Energy demand and GDP growth grow pretty much together. So, conservation is part of it, but it isn't the whole answer. Renewables, wind, solar. I used to be sort of look down my nose at solar. I learned a little geography. We're on the same latitude as southern France. We think of ourselves, we think if you go due east from Maine, you'll hit England. No, you'll hit southern France. England is on the same parallel with Hudson's Bay. And Scandinavia is, England and Scandinavia wouldn't be habitable but for the Gulf Stream. And that's my first passing message of mention of global climate change. If something happens to the ocean currents, all bets are off. Those countries would not be habitable. And right now, if you go to southern Ireland, there are palm trees. Did you know that? There are palm trees in southern Ireland because of the Gulf Stream. But we do have a significant solar percentage in this area. And in fact, it's better than some areas of the country. It depends on cloud cover thing. But solar is an option for us. I think we're going to see the day when every house, instead of shingles, has shingles, which are also photovoltaics. You're going to, you know, you got to put shingles on your house. Why not put shingles on your house and make electricity? I think that's coming. There are people madly working on that right now. So that's the kind of opportunity that's coming. So solar geothermal has significant potential in Maine, not to drill down into, you know, Old Faithful. But as you probably know, at 5 feet deep, it's always 45 degrees. And so there is energy down there. And geothermal is an option. Air-to-air heat pumps are options. And a heat pump is 4 times as efficient as a baseboard. So those are important. Wind power is a significant resource in Maine. Maine has more wind resources onshore than any other place in New England. I can tell you it's not easy to develop those onshore resources. I can show you the scars. Everybody seems to be supportive of alternative energy, just not on their mountain. But that's got to be something. That's got to be part of the mix. It's got to be part of the silver buckshot. Is developing, and the reason the onshore is still important is you can do it in a reasonable period of time, 2 or 3 years. And we need to develop these new resources. The general growth of electricity demand in New England is about 1% a year, 30,000 megawatts. So generally in New England, once we get out of this recession, which hopefully it will be soon, 1% a year, 300 megawatts a year of new power is going to be necessary. Where is it going to come from? I think wind is a reasonable source. It's one of the sources. It's not the only source. And that leads me to the ocean. First, I want to say I have no commercial or business interest in offshore energy. I'm too old. It's going to take too long. But I'm not, so I just, every now and then somebody says, well, King's only pressing this because he's in the wind business. Well, not offshore. But let's talk about it offshore. The Gulf of Maine has enough wind potential, if it was fully developed, to provide power for everybody in New England, or really probably from New York State up. The wind potential in the Gulf of Maine is gigantic. It blows more frequently, more consistently, and it is a huge energy resource, an enormous energy resource. The question is, how do we capture it? How do we work together to capture it? How do we resolve conflicts? And why even try? Here's the big idea. Don't think of offshore wind as a source of electricity for lights and computers. A 5,000 megawatt wind project, 1,005 megawatt turbines in the Gulf of Maine, would supply enough energy to completely take Maine off of oil through electric heat pumps for our homes and buildings and plug-in cars. That's the breakthrough idea. It isn't an electricity project, it's an energy project. And that's what we're really trying to think about. Why do it? Well, I can tell you from having worked with Kathleen and George and others on the Offshore Energy Task Force, you immediately start talking about a project like this, and everybody focuses on the impacts. What's this going to do to fishing? What's it going to do to shipping? What's it going to do to whales? What's it going to do to birds? You know, what are the impacts? That's fine. We've got to ask those questions. But we also have to ask the question, what are the impacts if we don't do it? What are the impacts of doing nothing? What are the social, economic, cultural, environmental impacts of doing nothing? So you've got to weigh that. You can't just say, oh, this is going to have impacts, because if we do nothing, folks, we're going to have some serious impacts. If oil goes to $300 a barrel, which reasonable people predict it will, it's gone from 30 to 80 in 6 months, back up to 80 this week. That means gasoline is $10 a gallon, home heating oil is $10 to $12 a gallon. At that point, Maine is uninhabitable. We are a big one-season national park. Ken Burns can come and do a documentary. And the question is, okay, do we do it? When do we do it? What do we have to do? There are a whole series of steps. If we started today, if President Obama or the Wizard of Oz or whoever waved a wand and said, build the offshore energy project, it would take 10 to 15 years, starting today. What are the barriers? The first is technical. We don't know how to do it. There's 1,000 megawatts of wind power offshore in Europe, but it's all shallow water. The posts go into the sand. I think of them as windmills standing in water up to their knees. Okay? The posts go into the bottom. Maine is different because, you know, you go 400 feet off the coast of Maine and you're in deep water. So the trick is developing a technology to attach a wind turbine to an oil rig or some other kind of floating platform. And it's a, quite an engineering challenge because you can't have the thing rocking back and forth with the waves. They're very big, very large, a lot of weight at the top. So there's an R&D challenge. That's number one. We've got to figure out what the technology is and how to do it economically. The second challenge is regulatory. I was surprised in working with the Ocean Energy Task Force at the level of regulation in deep water. Within 3 miles, you have state regulation, but after 3 miles, it's federal, and there are a lot of agencies. NOAA, National Marine Fisheries Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, Army Corps of Engineers, Marine Minerals Service. You know, so I've got five agencies right now. And so far anyway, and I want to be diplomatic here. I'm always known as being very diplomatic. Those agencies aren't famous for playing well together. A huge challenge in doing this is working out a regulatory scheme that will allow the appropriate analysis of the impacts, protection of the environment, work with community groups, all that kind of thing, and yet still not take 8 or 9 years and anywhere from $25 to $50 million. Cape Wind has been in permitting for 9 years. It's cost almost $30 million just to get the permits. We can't afford that. So our strategy is, and by the way, we wouldn't build it today even if we could because it's not economic. Fossil fuel prices are too low. This price would be high. It would have to be 25 cents a kilowatt hour. And you may say, oh Lord, that's awful. It's now only 15. I predict we'll all live long enough to a time when we look back and say, 25 cents a kilowatt hour, boy, that sounds pretty good. Because there are places in the world already where it's 40 cents, 50 cents a kilowatt hour. So it's got to be economic. Our strategy is, though, let's work on the regulatory piece. Let's work on the R&D piece so we're ready to do it when and if it makes sense. And I can tell you exactly when it makes sense. When you drive down the road and you see $3.66 for gasoline, that's when you can say to yourself, ah, the offshore wind project makes sense. That's about the break point, $3.50 to $4 a gallon. Then it'll work. Finally, good. Pinky says, good. You're supposed to say, no, you can go. Finally. Mary says I say finally too much. It gets people's hopes up. There's a big economic development piece of this. Jobs are a valuable environmental quality, value. We've lost thousands of manufacturing jobs in this state in the last 20 years. The potential for this to create 10 to 20,000 good jobs in Maine is really there. It's really significant. The University of Maine just recently got a grant from the federal government to be the offshore wind research center for the country. That's huge because they're going to be working on the the technology side, the R&D side. They're also going to be working under that grant on the regulatory side, trying to work that out. This is an enormous step forward. The state has designated test areas, or is designating demonstration areas through legislation passed last spring unanimously by the legislature. I couldn't get the legislature to vote unanimously on the time of day. The legislature passed this legislation unanimously, the governor signed it, and they're now designated demonstration areas, and I'm happy to announce here today that one of the demonstration areas is right in front of my house. Damerscove Island. I'm going to look right at it. So all the people have been yelling at me in the mountains about, well, you wouldn't want to look at one, I get to look at one and I'm delighted. This one is a record to show. So a lot's going on, and if you don't know Habib Dagar at the university, he's the guy that's really led this and has been fantastically successful in gaining this status for being as the place to do the research on offshore wind. Tidal, I didn't mention, tidal is also significant. It's not as big as the wind resource, but it's something that we have to develop. But all of these obstacles, how to work with people, how to work with the community groups, the fishermen, the folks that are concerned about marine mammals, all of those things we can and we must do. We can and we must do. The future is really within our hands. The dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate to the stormy present. The occasion is piled high with difficulty, and therefore we must rise with the occasion, as our cases do. So we must think anew and act anew. We must disenthrall ourselves. And then we shall save our country.